Committee on Public Safety and Justice Reform, Finance, Policy Division to order. We have several bills before us today, and we also have work that we want to finish off from last night. I trust everyone was able to get some sleep. I will admit, I slept in and missed a couple meetings this morning. I think our staff has also been, we're also pretty impacted, so we're doing a lot of last-minute kind of adjusting here, but hopefully all the information that we need to conduct our business is before us. Members, I'm going to call Representative Dean forward for House File 897. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to ask a couple of other individuals who actually are the people that run the JDAI, or Juvenile Detention Alternatives program in the state of Minnesota. House file.
Representative Dean, why don't we get a motion from you, and then we'll have the bill formally before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that this be laid over for possible inclusion. I'm not sure we need to go anywhere else.
That is correct.
Okay, so I'll make that motion.
Very well, thank you. I take it you want to go straight to your testifiers? Is that?
Well, I'll speak to the bill, and then I'll let them speak, and quite honest, they're here as friends, so they can be phoned if needed. For those of you who have not been here in the past, we've worked really, really diligently in the state of Minnesota to address diversion for juveniles that have offenses that in many ways aren't egregious, aren't at that point that they should immediately enter the criminal justice system. These are actually four offenses that we believe diverting young people away from the criminal justice is actually more beneficial to them, but ultimately more beneficial to all of us. In the end, it makes our communities safer. And surprisingly enough, this is a very economic way of addressing some offenses that when young people enter our detention system, it becomes very, very expensive. So over the past several years, we've a few counties have adopted this program. The few being key were Ramsey, Hennepin, St. Louis, and Dakota County that have worked relatively around this and have shown great results. And this program has been trying to expand statewide, so into other counties. And the other counties aren't quite as simple, if I could say that, as counties like Hennepin, Dakota, Ramsey, in that there are a lot of overlaying jurisdictions and other types of things that become critical. For instance, right now the program is working to bring on several county area up in northwestern Minnesota, and this is overlaying with some of the tribal nations to be engaged as part of the process as well. And this bill has a financial impact because the expansion and running of the program takes money. Currently, we are moving forward with continuing the grant program through Office of Justice Programs, but I will also let you know that there are current conversations happening at the executive level about where this program will lie. In other states, it lies in areas like Department of Correction or other areas, and we want to make sure that we get this right moving forward. So right now the bill establishes grants through Office of Justice Program, but I also wanted to be very clear with folks on the committee that there are current discussions that are happening that are beyond my pay grade, and we'll see what happens when that moves forward. And I'd like to turn it over to Curtis Shankland, the director, so he can fill in any spots I may have missed or give you maybe a little background that he think would be helpful to all of you. So,
Mr. Shankland. We've had some good conversations with my office and you and your colleague. We're very impressed with the work that JDAI has done in the state of Minnesota, and we know that it's part of a national movement as well. So we look forward to some good, quick background information about what you do, and then talk to us about this bill.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, and all those in attendance. I think I want to say first and foremost, thank you all just for your time and just for the opportunity to speak not only about JDAI, but also the great work and the success that we have had. I should say that, I guess, with a little caveat. I've kind of been at this for a while. I've been involved in the criminal justice system now for almost 20 years in many different facets, all the way back from working as a corrections counselor to both a juvenile and adult probation officer, kind of working my way up to do more admin work, working on policy. I'm also a PREA auditor through the Department of Justice. I also teach a class on the criminal court process at one of our state local colleges.
Mr. Shankland, I'm going to interrupt you. I apologize for being rude, but per our process, we need to state your full name for the record.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Full name, Curtis L. Shankland.
Thank you.
With that being said, although I come from this not only with a background in academia, but also come from this with a background of, as myself and my colleague Ms. Dester like to say, we've been in the trenches doing this work. You will never hear us say no child should ever be placed in secure confinement. Unfortunately, that's just not the reality. Sometimes our youth make some very unfortunate choices that do warrant them to at times be placed in secure confinement. However, the overwhelmingly vast majority of our youth could be serviced outside of being placed in secure confinement without compromising public safety. And that's what JDAI sought to do when it was first inception over 25 years ago, and what we have had success doing up until present day now. So just a quick little background about JDAI. JDAI first came about during the early 90s. During that time, it was during the super predator years, when we were taking a more punitive approach on how we were dealing with many of our adults and youth who came involved in the criminal justice system. JDAI came in to say, you know, we can reduce the detention populations with many of our youth who we found in secure confinement, many of them for lower level offenses or persons or property crimes, that we can reduce those numbers without compromising public safety. 25 years to this day, JDI has been the most replicated juvenile justice reform model to this day. Over a 50% drop in detention facilities across the nation. Started out with 5 pilot sites to this day. There's at least 1 site in over 42 states, and there's over 300 jurisdictions across the nation. So let's talk about Minnesota. Here in Minnesota, we've mirrored that success. As you all are probably aware, Minnesota doesn't have a juvenile justice governing body. We are of the mindset that JDAI has filled that void over the last 14 years. As Representative Dean alluded to, we started out with 3 pilot sites, Ramsey, Hennepin, and Dakota County. That was back in 2005. In 2009, we then expanded to St. Louis County. In 2015, we then brought on Rice County. My colleague will talk a little bit about the numbers because everything that we do is data driven to speak to some of the successes. But just a quick little tidbit about that is before Dakota County was getting ready to come on as a JDAI site, they were looking at building a new juvenile justice facility. They came on as a JDAI site and no longer had the need for that because they were able to revamp not only their practices and policies to ensure that youth who otherwise could be treated outside of the system were getting the resources they need without compromising public safety. To this date, over 3 years ago, we were able to successfully get appropriations to expand. My predecessor at that time had proposed that we would bring on 3 new counties. Now, I should say that when we say bring on a county, that doesn't mean a county just gets to say, hey, I like your work, I'm a JDAI site. We require a county board resolution before any site can become a JDAI site. We are the only state out of the 42 in the nation that would require that. So that is one of the ways Minnesota has been a leader in juvenile justice reform across the nation. When we were able to get those appropriations, we didn't just bring on 3 new sites, we brought on 9 new sites in one tribal nation. Again, out of the 25 years, another way in which Minnesota has been a leader, we brought on the largest cohort in over a decade of sites to come on as a JDI site. Along with that, we are the only state to bring on a tribal nation, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, as an expansion site. So Minnesota has been a leader across the nation when it comes to juvenile justice reform through its practices that have been affected by the work of JDAI. However, there have been some instances where JDAI and the state of Minnesota has not been leaders in a couple things. When you talk about disparities, and I had a conversation with the chair when we were talking about how did the criminal justice aspect of this title get attached to the committee, and I told him I was very impressed with that. He let me know that he could not take the credit, that was kind of started by the speaker, so I guess I owe an appreciation to her as well. But my thought is, if we're going to talk about criminal justice reform, you can't do that without addressing the elephant in the room, which is that the vast majority of not only our adults, but our youth who we find in the system are youth of color. And that is true here in Minnesota. When it comes to desperate treatment of our Native American youth placed in secure confinement after arrest, Minnesota ranks number 1 in the nation. When it comes to African-American youth who are placed in secure confinement after arrest, Minnesota ranks number 5 in the nation. So with all the great work that we have done, we still have a lot of great work left to go. But that is also the foundation of our work, is how do we address the racial and ethnic disparities within the system, but how do we get out of this justice by geography? I can ensure that in the JDAI sites, that all of them use a validated risk assessment instrument that will ensure that there's equity amongst those youth who wind up in the criminal justice system. And when I say equity, I'm going to make sure to differentiate that before when we're talking about equality. I liken it to this. Equality would be if everyone in this room had a pair of shoes. If we were talking about equity would be everyone having a pair of shoes in this room that fits. So when we're doing our work, we're striving to see how can we provide equity across the system and how can we have consistency amongst our practices and policies that affect our youth. And that's what led us going up to the 9th Judicial District. So when we were looking to expand, we didn't want to just take the easy way out and just bring on sites to just bring them on. We wanted to be intentional about, addressing racial and ethnic disparities, but how do we get out of this justice by geography? There are many of our youth who are in more rural Minnesota who are struggling with issues around chemical dependency and mental health and have a lack of resources to address their needs. So many of times we're using an institutional response to address these needs, or we rely on our secure detention facilities that become the dumping grounds for our youth. So that's what Minnesota JDI has sought out to address and what we have been successful in addressing along this way. As I've had the opportunity to sit in this committee over the couple of days, a couple other points that I've noticed, I know Representative Long and Representative Zerwas have both been working on bills that will change the way that we look at probation and look at ways to affect that. JDAI has been a leader on that in the juvenile justice world now for the last 14 years. I know Representative O'Neill, and there are some representatives from Anoka County who essentially are doing JDAI on the adult world now with a pilot site. We've been at that doing this now for over 14 years, and I know the chair mentioned during that presentation that a lot of times the body looks for someone to come in and be able to demonstrate how this has been sustainable and been successful over a long period of time. Our work fits that bill. We've been at this for 14 years, again, addressing those same components and have had high success doing so. And I also know when I was listening to both Representative Johnson and Representative Lucero, when Representative Adelson was talking about victim impact, and they made the comment, who's going to be looking out for our kids? And for us, I think we all can agree that many of our youth are products of their environment. And so for JDAI, we look to say we're the ones that are going to look out for the kids, because we ensure that when we're talking about youth, that you're doing it through the My Child test, which means that if your child got into trouble or was with a group of youth who got into trouble. How would you want their experience to be to ensure that they no longer have contact with the system, or when they do come into contact with the system, that is one to, that will ensure that it meets their needs and that it would decrease the chances of them coming back? Because what we do know is when you do introduce a youth into the system, the chances of them committing a felony increase by over 60%. We enhance their criminogenic risk factors. So for us, everything that we do is, again, about being data-driven, and how can we continue along this line to continue to make the best impact that we have for our youth here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Shanklin. Ms. Dexter.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Committee. My name is Katrina Dexter. I'm currently the JDI State Co-Coordinator with Mr. Shanklin over at the Association of Minnesota Counties. I come to this work much like Mr. Shanklin, with over a decade of experience in the criminal justice system. I've worked with both adults and juveniles in residential detention facilities, as well as in the community working with them on probation. And so my experience is really driven by being involved in JDI when I was a probation officer. And so when I came to this work at the state level, I knew how it impacted families on the local level, and it really impacted the system on a local level. And so much like Representative Dean and Mr. Shanklin have testified to today, is that JDI has been the most successful reform effort in the state of Minnesota to date. That being said, I'd like to share some data with you today to give some context to that success. Minnesota JDI collects key indicators to track the progress of reform efforts made by our local JDI sites. One of these indicators is annual admissions to detention, so how many admissions we have into a detention facility by youth within our counties. Prior to engaging JDI, our sites had over an annual admission rate of over 9,000 admissions per year. After implementing JDI strategies, our sites have been able to decrease those annual admissions to 3,300 a year, less than that. That's a 65% decrease in annual admissions to our JDI sites, all while protecting public safety. Additionally, we track failure to appear rates. And so prior to engaging JDI, our sites had over 6,700 instances of youth failing appear for court, and that oftentimes relates and ends up with them having a warrant. And so our sites have tackled that. They've implemented strategies to focus on failures to appear. And since the time of engaging JDAI, they've been able to decrease those failures to appear to less than 60 a year. That's a 99% decrease in failures to appear for youth within our JDAI sites for court appearances specifically. These are just two examples of the positive impact JDAI has had on our state and our juvenile justice system here in Minnesota. The continued work of JDI will allow for more jurisdictions across the state, including northern and southern Minnesota, outside of our metro area, to have positive outcomes for youth, much like we've discussed here today. Chairman and committee, I thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions if need be.
Thank you, Ms. Dexter. Other questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just explain to the committee what you do like on a daily basis? Because I understand it's just the two of you that run the office. And so, you know, I heard a lot of stuff, but I'm not quite sure exactly what you do on a daily basis.
Ms. Dexter.
We popcorn questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
And Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you weren't asking me, Representative.
No. Okay. Thank you.
At least we think we know. Ms. Dexter.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative O'Neill, thank you for asking. So you're looking at the state JDI team up here, Mr. Shanklin and I, and our work is varied in what it looks like. And so we have done everything from our state level work, which is the state scale work, bringing it to model across all 87 counties, which is our goal. We're in the process of doing that. What happens when we bring on a site is that we do a comprehensive systems assessment for them to come on. So we do a qualitative and quantitative system assessment within their county. So we actually interview all stakeholders. That includes anyone from the judiciary all the way to the public, the community, families, the judiciary, public defense, schools, Am I missing somebody?
Prosecutors.
Thank you, Mr. Shanklin. So all the stakeholders in the justice system. And we interview them and figure out what they're kind of doing in their county, what their current practices are. And then we also look at their data. And we try to look at it over at least 5 years so we can see what's been going on in their county. We then take that and give them some sort of assessment back that gives them some basis on what they're doing really well and areas that they could improve some of their outcomes and areas that they can focus on, much like failures to appear. And so we work with the counties then moving forward to actually implement the work of that systems assessment. So they create work plans, a one-year work plan, a three-year work plan, and then a five-year work plan to figure out what they're going to do to change their system based on not only data, but also what their practices changes over time. And so we look at that, and then we keep up with the counties. We provide technical assistance to every single county that we have on currently. So even our most experienced sites in Hennepin, Tocotia, and Ramsey. We still are involved in those daily and are available if they need anything. We still go down and attend their meetings or are involved in their process as well. And so we are really intricate into pushing the work in local JDI sites, but also a huge part of our work is trying to get this to be a statewide effort and really moving towards making sure all kids in Minnesota have justice that looks the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if there's just the two of you in the office, how will you spend 2.5 million in the next two out years? Where does that go? Because that's a big salary, if that's just salary, but can you explain where that goes?
Thank you, Chair, Representative O'Neill. Well, we're not in the private sector, so I know that's not... but as Ms. Dexter alluded to, not only do we coordinate all that, but a lot of the work is facilitating. And since you're looking at the two, if we're going to look to get into all 87 counties, we're also the first to come up with a multi-jurisdictional approach. Many times when sites are brought on, they're brought on one site at a time. We're the first state in the nation to bring on sites in a conglomerate as a multi-jurisdictional approach. So when you're talking about that 1.5 million, in order for this to go statewide, we would have to expand our capacity. So you're talking about going in through each of the judicial districts to expand through there. So that would be used for coordinators. Each one of our local sites also encompass a coordinator who then looks to facilitate the work as well. So that would not only be for our capacity, but it also be for ensuring our alternatives to detention that are utilized and that are necessary for all our counties to improvise and to move forward doing the work. So those allocations of appropriations not only will be used for the enhancement of our team, so it's not just myself and Katrina who are coordinating the work, but again, to bring on data experts, we're the only two now who are doing the data. Again, there is no central repository for data here in Minnesota. So not only expanding our capacity for the work that we can do, but also we will also need to bring on local coordinators. Our model to this has always been state-led, county-driven. So in all of our sites where we have brought those sites on, the work has then become institutionalized, and then those counties now have the work embedded within those sites. So the work will go and the funding will go to the expansion of our office and our team so that we can see these efforts in all 87 counties across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're going to grow your operation from 2 to 5 million, and I'm not quite sure how many FTEs that is, because it's 5 million in the ask over the biennium.
Right. Chair Representative O'Neill, just an example. When we successfully got appropriations through the state legislature 3 years ago, at that time we had a budget of $600,000 and we had proposed to bring on three new sites. We were able to use that funding to bring on nine new sites, and that was just with $600,000 that we had at our capacity to not only expand our office, but to bring on those nine new counties in that one tribal nation. So with $5 million over the biennial, $2.5 million a year, we would be able to use that to have JDAI in all 87 states, in all 87 counties through the judicial districts for our expansion work.
Last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have an estimation of how many FTEs that would require?
Mr. Shanklin.
What?
Or Ms. Dexter.
We're in discussions about how many FTEs that will actually take, but another piece of this work is that it really is the county driven as well. And so when we invest in counties, we also invest. So for example, Hennepin, Dakota, Ramsey all have a local site coordinator. And so we invest in them on the front end. We collaborate with the county on the front end to help them build up that position. And then the county takes over that paying for that position as time goes on. So when we bring on a county, there's an initial investment by the state of by the state and the Minnesota JDI team to invest in the county to help them bring on a coordinator and help that. But as time goes on, the county takes over that. And so part of that is that process of knowing there's 10 judicial districts in the state of Minnesota. So based on how many counties we have come on, that will base on how many local coordinators we need as well. And so it's really driven by how quickly we can move the work. But when it comes to the state team, at the very least, we need at least one or two more, I would say. I mean, one person at least would be really nice to at least focus on our data piece. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Miller on this point, I believe.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, a quick question that might feed off of what you're asking, Representative O'Neill, and this might be for the author, it might be for staff or something, but this is a pretty big, by the way, I love what you guys are doing, and I told them I can't wait for them to come out to my county because I think it would be real beneficial, so I'm a big homer on this one. But to her point, I guess the question is this a big jump in budget. So who has oversight above you guys on this budget and how the money is spent? Is it the Department of Public Safety or who exactly? Can you answer that, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Miller. I almost said Moeller. you know, currently it is Public Safety through OJP, which is currently facilitating the program. You know, when you look at the $2.5 million, that seems like a lot of money. And compared to most things, it is. Compared to our federal budget or over our state budget, it's not a lot. But it is, you know, in many ways, that cost of bringing on these new coordinators in these new locations that have an initial cost. And one of the ways in which we can actually sort of smooth that is by having some resources when we go to the counties to help them get established and to help them get started.
One more quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Miller.
And I get that. I don't necessarily have a problem with the dollar, and I'm not going to question it down to the dollars. I'm just saying, so for a simple question like who sets their salaries, who determines when a county gets help funded, how much they get, who gets distributed, just the general oversight, because I'm not hearing that there's a board, I think in nonprofit terms, of course, right? So I'm not hearing a board over this, and I hear in a department over this, and I hear it's an office in the department. And this isn't an issue of questioning whether they're spending it right. You just need to have oversight, checks, and balances. And so just real simply, what does that look like? And okay. It can be a simple version.
Oh, yes, yes. Chair, Representative Miller, we're currently officed out of the Association of Minnesota Counties. We also have a state advisory board that is comprised both of county officials, elected officials. It's mostly of the executive level that all sit around our state advisory board that are overseers for us, not only in our budget but the work.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Very good questions. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm looking at on the bill line 2.11 and 2.12. Commissioner shall ensure that most of the grant money distributed into under this section is to be used to benefit Greater Minnesota. I'm wondering if you can define most, because most could be 50.0001% to 99.9999%. What is the makeup you're looking at here? Normally we have a dollar amount or a percentage.
And I believe, Representative Dean, in the earlier testimony, the part of the testimony was about being able to expand into judiciary districts where you're not as present. It sounds like there's a heavy presence currently in the Twin Cities area, perhaps some of the regional centers. So that might help with part of this, but... Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I think you nailed it. Since the program is already up and running in the Twin Cities and in the counties that it is, when I read the word most in this context, it could be as high as 80 to 90%. But then the question becomes, you know, where do the staff live? Where do they earn their salaries? So I think to actually put an exact amount would be probably beyond what I think we're qualified to do. And I'm always at times a fan of allowing individuals to make the decisions that are best for what they're trying to do. But when you use the term most in this context on 2.11 and 2.12, I would say that a majority of the grant money will be distributed in areas outside of the Twin Cities.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. I've been here long enough. When we've had terms like most, it usually doesn't work out well. That's why we usually had a percentage. I believe if they've been around for 14 years, they have a good idea where their money is going now. They should be able to help you to come up with a very close percentage where a minimum amount would be going to Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shankle. Chair, Representative Johnson, point well taken. And even in prior legislation when we had most, and which is why I spoke to our intentionality, which is why we went up to the 9th Judicial District. And we used all of those fundings to help with our work up in Greater Minnesota. And that was bringing on counties everywhere from Roseau to Hubbard, Manoman, Lake of the Woods, Cass, Pennington, Clearwater, Manoman, Coochiching. And so the fact that we've pretty much have all the counties here in the metro, that has been one of our intentional goals, is to show that this work is just not metro-centric. And that's why we went up to the 9th Judicial District. So our goal would be to be as far down as Marshall, Minnesota, that I'm familiar with back when it was SSU. I know it's SMSU now, but all the way up to Halleck, Minnesota, which is where we have currently spent a lot of our time.
Mr. Shanklin, I take it that your board is representative of that kind of regional diversity. I heard description at the board. So you're housed at Minnesota Association of Counties. You have a board of county officials. I think the testimony was even at the executive level. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm asking about the regional diversity of the board.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that for you. Yes, so when we bring on counties, we incorporate people from those counties onto our state advisory committee. So as our expansion has grown, our committee has grown as well. And so we try to bring people on from the executive level so that we have people that are decision makers at the table. But yes, we include people and we incorporate people as we expand counties.
It might be helpful to share, mm-hmm. Representative Dean, with the committee at some point, or even just point us to where committee members can take a glance of what the governing structure is and who the players are in that governing structure.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to do that. And in full disclosure, I do sit on the State Advisory Committee as well.
Very well. Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is for either of the testifiers. We visited over the past few sessions and such, and how much are the counties putting into this program? I know you talked about working with them, and they're putting up some personnel or whatever, but how much are they actually putting in?
Mr. Shank.
Chair, Representative Grosso, thank you for the question. A specific dollar amount, I would say it varies. Again, when we go in and we incentivize the counties to come on, they then take over the work. So if I give an example and say St. Louis County, before when we came on, St. Louis County didn't have a coordinator. We were able to incentivize them. They now have not only hired a coordinator, but have embedded that coordinator into their budget. At the same time, they also didn't have community coaches at the time to actually go out and coordinate the work for them on the local level. Those positions have now embedded into their own local budget. And so when we talk about incurring the cost, the fact that the work becomes institutionalized, the county then is responsible for all those costs with them, and we no longer then incentivize them with any dollars moving forward, because that is our whole goal, to make sure that this work becomes institutionalized and sustainable within those counties. So a direct dollar figure, I couldn't put on it. I mean, I can give an estimation, but I would say the fact that they pick up those FTEs with those costs becomes the cost of those counties, and that they're willing to do that because of the cost savings that come. As Ms. Dexter alluded to, when you look at the number of youth who you are no longer now having to pay a per diem to be at your local detention facility, that enables the counties to be able to absorb those costs because they're no longer having those out-of-pocket costs because they're saving dollars from the lack of youth that they're no longer placing into secure confinement arbitrarily.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Russell. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair. As a Greater Minnesota member, we're now, what, 1/5 of the population. So if we get 50% in a penny, that's actually a pretty good deal, and I'm pretty happy with it. But you mentioned there was 5,700 less juvenile detention placements in a year. Do you have a dollar figure to go with that? I mean, that's, what, $100 a day, $125 a day, times 5,700, times multiple days. That's got to be a lot.
Ms. Dexter.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative. Yes, I can't do the quick math for you because I'm not a math major. I wish I was that quick. But, yes, we've had millions of dollars of cost savings. $20 million? Just in the metro area is kind of the rough average that we've been given from our counties. And so when you have, on average, it costs $200 a night to hold a kid in a juvenile detention facility in the state of Minnesota, every one of those dollars add up. And some of the things we see in these counties is that, you know, you can change a small practice of just not detaining kids for one night, and that's thousands upon thousands of dollars at the end of the year. Thank you for the question.
Sure. Sounds like a bargain.
Very well. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House File 897? If not, then Representative Dean, final words, and then we'll...
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would renew my motion to lay this over for possible inclusion. And I just want to say that, you know, this is one of the areas that is truly an investment. And as Representative Considine just mentioned, this is having significant returns. And I think the more and more we put resources in the place that are going to be offsetting future costs, it really is a good service to the taxpayers of Minnesota. So I want to thank everybody for their support and look forward to this moving forward.
Thank you, Representative Dean, for bringing us this bill. Ms. Dexter, Mr. Shanklin, thank you for the work that you do in our state, and look forward to continuing this conversation with you as we construct our omnibus bill. The chair then lays over House File 897 for possible inclusion. What was that? So we're not bringing up?
No.
Come up?
Yes. She's going to speak to all the other bills.
Oh, I see. Very well. Is Perry, I'm going to butcher this, Moriarty?
Moriarty.
Mr. Chair, just think of Sherlock Holmes.
A villain, though.
Moriarty.
Moriarty,
you know, I'm a Chicago boy. I should be able to get these Irish names. I presume it's Irish, but perhaps not. And Ms. Moriarty. You're here to give us a brief testimony about the upcoming bills here.
Yes, we'll thank you. Thank bills. You, Mr. Chair. I am, and unfortunately, I'm actually Professor Moriarty.
Professor doesn't exist. And welcome
and
to the
Mr.
committee.
Chair, if you'll forgive me, I do have some media, just a few media slides. Is it? And they are keyed up here. I can proceed without them.
Why don't we do that, okay. Professor?
Good afternoon. My name is Perry Moriarty, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, where I teach the juvenile justice and child advocacy clinic. I teach criminal law and juvenile law and some other courses. Our clinic represents youth in delinquency cases in juvenile court, in inmates serving life sentences for juvenile offenses, and third-party custodians for children who would otherwise be in the child welfare system. And my research focuses broadly in the areas of juvenile justice with an emphasis on juvenile sentencing, adolescent development, and the overrepresentation of youth of color in the juvenile justice system. Thank you, Chair Mariani, and members of this committee for allowing me to address you today. My testimony is intended to frame the broader discussion, which I understand will be focused going forward on juvenile justice. Almost anyone who has ever interacted with adolescents will agree that they are different from adults. They can be more rash, more impulsive, less thoughtful, and less gracious. They take more risks, and they succumb more easily to peer pressure. These observable differences have long informed our laws. In most states, we do not allow children to drive until they are 16, vote until they are 18, and drink until they are 21. We mandate that they remain in school, and in some cities, that they come home before midnight. Over the last decade, these perceived differences between adolescents and adults have become grounded in science. Increasingly sophisticated scans of the adolescent brain have told us four key things about brain maturation. First, we used to believe that the vast majority of brain development took place during the first decade of life. Brain scans now show that the front third of the human brain, the prefrontal cortex, is still developing throughout adolescence and into the 20s. This is the executive part of the human brain. It controls what we attend to and the extent to which we plan our actions. Second, the limbic system, the part of the brain that is responsible for reward seeking and is stimulated by social and emotional variables, develops earlier and faster than the prefrontal cortex. This means that until the cortex can catch up with the limbic system, the desire for rewards and social pressures overrides rational thinking. It's like starting the engine before the brakes are fully in place. Third, the adolescent brain experiences spikes of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. Dopamine is often called the happy neurotransmitter. The more of this chemical we have circulating in our brains, the happier we feel. The growth of dopamine receptors during adolescence, along with the enhanced dopamine supply, provides an emotional rush that adults just don't feel when engaged in the same activities. Finally, it's not that there is a lack of brain activity during adolescence, it's the opposite. The teen brain is a bustling construction, demolition, and reconstruction site. Cells and connecting synapses are being grown, used, and strengthened, or not used, pruned, and replaced. These connections are like a jumbled mess of cords that have yet to be connected, or in some cases, are superfluous. So what does all of this tell us about adolescent behavior? It helps explain why adolescents can seem intellectually sophisticated and yet also impulsive, rash, and sometimes foolish. It explains why adolescents are less likely to consider the consequences of their actions and to weigh both risks and rewards in decision-making. It is why adolescents experience higher highs and lower lows than adults, and why they are especially sensitive to emotional cues, social stimuli, and rewards. It explains why, when there is pressure to make a decision quickly, when there is an opportunity for risk-seeking behavior, or when emotions run high, adolescent judgment may be driven by emotion rather than by reason. It explains why adolescents are more likely to have car accidents, to drown, to attempt suicide, to experiment with drugs, and to commit crimes. What does this mean for our laws? And specifically, what does it tell us about how to deal with those adolescents who break the law? The same brain scans that explain adolescent behavior also tell us two other very important things. This behavior generally dissipates by the early to mid-20s, and because their brains are not yet fixed, adolescents are more amenable to rehabilitation. They are capable of change. For decades, our juvenile justice system seemed to recognize this. It was established at the turn of the 20th century to shield youth from the criminal process. When the first juvenile court was founded in 1899, charges against adolescents were deemed civil rather than criminal. Social workers replaced lawyers, prosecutors, and juries. Crimes became delinquent behavior. These were the norms for much of the 20th century. In nearly every meaningful way, however, this changed dramatically during the 1980s and 1990s. With a rise in crime rates among adolescents came calls to get tough on juvenile crime. Every state in the country did this, making it easier to try and punish children as adults, weakening confidentiality laws, lowering the age of juvenile court jurisdiction, and establishing mandatory minimum sentences for youth. With the turn of the 21st century, however, as our understanding of the brain development and adolescent behavior has increased, a number of these punitive laws are being called into question. Over the last 15 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has issued a series of decisions in which it relied on some of the brain science I just described, holding that three fundamental features of adolescence, lack of maturity, vulnerability to negative influences, and increased capacity for change, make children, quote, constitutionally different from adults and, quote, less deserving of the most severe punishments. These decisions and the science behind them have prompted courts and policymakers across the country to reexamine the principles, laws, and policies of their state juvenile justice system. I am grateful that this committee is willing to do the same. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Moriarty. Are there any questions? Very well. Thank you for the strong framing that you've provided us and for your research work as well. With that, we're going to pull up House File 1678, Representative Edelson. And Representative Edelson, I'm going to ask your testifiers to come forward as well. Just want to make sure we're efficient with our time here. And Representative Edelson, I believe your motion is to lay House File 1678 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Chair, that is correct.
Very well. So moved, and your bill is before us.
Chair and members, House File 1678 focuses on three critical changes to our juvenile justice system. One is ending the practice of indiscriminately shackling our children. We should not be putting kids in wrist and ankle shackles unless there is an actual safety or flight risk. It is profoundly humiliating and traumatic for children and their families. We don't do this to adults in court, and we shouldn't do this to kids. This legislation.
I'm here today to ask you to support House File 1678. As you've heard, the legislation focuses on three important changes to our juvenile justice system here in Minnesota. So first, I'd like to focus on the shackling provision. So Article 1, Section 1 of the legislation would end the practice of indiscriminately shackling children in our juvenile courts. Indiscriminate shackling of children unnecessarily humiliates, stigmatizes, and traumatizes them. Across Minnesota, children facing low-level offenses, children who pose no flight or safety risk, are shackled in court. The practice runs counter to the presumption of innocence and draws into question the rehabilitative ideals of the juvenile court. I want to be clear, this legislation does not prohibit a judge from ordering the use of restraints in appropriate circumstances when an actual flight or safety risk exists. It simply seeks to end the practice of indiscriminately shackling kids in court. Across the United States, policymakers have acted to end this deeply harmful and unnecessary practice. As of September of 2018, 32 states had ended the practice of indiscriminately shackling children in juvenile court. Additionally, a wide array of national organizations have issued policy statements or resolutions opposing this practice, including the American Bar Association, the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, National Association of Counties, Child Welfare League of America, Mental Health America, National Association of Counsel for Children, National Prevention Science Coalition to Improve Lives, and others. I'm going to cut off the list there. I don't need to go on. There's a huge list of organizations across the spectrum of stakeholders who agree that this practice needs to end. Here in Minnesota, practice varies by geography. Several jurisdictions do not shackle children. For example, Hennepin County Court, where I practice, they don't shackle kids indiscriminately, while others do so regularly every single day. Research conducted specific to Minnesota indicates, including responses from all 10 judicial districts, found that the majority of Minnesota judges, 75% of judicial responses, are in favor of banning indiscriminate shackling in Minnesota, and more specifically, they would favor the limitation within their own jurisdiction. It's time for Minnesota to join the vast majority of states in ending this practice statewide. Moving on to talk about the second provision, which is police diversion, Article 1, Section 2 of the legislation, essentially would explicitly authorize police departments to send kids who commit nonviolent offenses to a community program instead of charging them. Bringing kids into court for minor offenses exposes them to lifelong collateral consequences, and we know that is bad for them and for our communities. Police should be able to divert low-risk youth into appropriate community-based programs where they can learn from their mistakes and give back to community. Police diversion programs prevent youth from having court records that can dramatically impact their ability to get a job later. This is already happening in some Minnesota cities with great success. For example, Minneapolis Police Department has had a very successful youth restorative justice diversion program for several years, and data demonstrates that the youth who participate are very successful. In reality, police departments in Minnesota already have this authority, but some are wary of starting their own program without actual statutory authority. This legislation will fix that and the practice of justice by geography and ensure that all Minnesota kids get this opportunity. Lastly, the risk assessment instrument, which is outlined in Article 2. You heard extensive testimony earlier from the JDAI representatives who were here. This legislation is not about seeking funding for this initiative. This legislation is really about just expanding the objective risk assessment instruments for making decisions about which kids can safely be supervised in the community and which kids need to be held in secure detention. It will ensure that youth are screened and treated consistently according to state statute and evidence-based risk criteria. Across Minnesota, as you've heard, many jurisdictions are already doing this, but others are detaining juveniles for nonviolent, low-level offenses or technical violations, which is bad for public safety, bad for kids, and costs us a lot of money. Several counties have already begun using the detention risk assessment instrument, and their results have consistently proven to safely reduce the unnecessary use of detention without impacting juvenile crime rates. And we do have another testifier here to speak more to their specific experience with this effort. I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Matt Bauer. I'm the superintendent for Dakota County Juvenile Services Center. We have a 40-bed secure facility in Dakota County located in Hastings, Minnesota. I'm here to testify about our experience with the risk assessment instrument. In 2003-2004, the Dakota County Juvenile Center was regularly at capacity or over capacity, 40-42 residents. We were looking at a costly expansion project. We had a couple options between $7 to $11 million for expansion. But then we also learned about a new initiative called JDI that we weren't familiar with, but Hennepin and Ramsey and us started to take a closer look at those options. We decided to go down the route of JDI. We decided that was the avenue we wanted to take. My job within our JDI efforts was to chair a committee to develop, design, and implement a risk assessment instrument array. To do this, we had to have political motivation and buy-in. We had that at that time with the necessary multi-million dollar expansion. We needed a stakeholder group reflective of our juvenile justice system. We convened a group in Dakota County of community corrections staff, county attorney's office, the public defender's office. We had 9 different law enforcement agencies in Dakota County on our committee to design this. We had social services, schools, and mental health officials as part of our committee to design the array. Our goal was to seek only the highest risk youth and the risk to reoffend before court, and those youth that are at high risk not to appear in court to be in our secure custody at the juvenile center. We developed the instrument, we implemented the instrument, and we saw success in that, reducing the number of youth in our facility. The average daily population in 2005 of Dakota County youth in our juvenile center was 35.5 youth. In 2008, it was 19. In 2015, it was 12.2. And last year, in 2018, the average daily population of Dakota County youth in our facility was 11.9. down from 35.5 in 2005-2006. During this time, the crime rates have gone down. We review data regularly. We compare it to the arrest, the felony charging report our county attorneys issue. The number of felonies charged in Dakota County from at 2009, when we were averaging 19 Dakota County kids, was 233 felonies charged. And now we're down to 11.5. And there was 163 felonies charged last year. So crime is not going up. We have seen crime continue to go down at high rates like everybody else. Even though we are screening kids, our process is they come in. We have decided what level of offense can come to the juvenile center for screening. We screen them. Some kids go to an alternative detention site. It might be a shelter. It might be a foster home. They may be able to go home on GPS or on house arrest until their court date. Some youth are eligible to be released with a summons to appear in court within 2 weeks, and then we track the success rate of those youth appearing in court. And we have a less than 5% rate of youth that do not make that court date, but we do not have any history or experience with any significant public safety risk occurring before they appear in court. So over the last 10, 12 years, we haven't had that huge issue that a lot of people may be concerned about happening. By releasing this, it's been safe for the public. That has been our experience in Dakota County. That's what I was here to share, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. I'm encouraged to hear the data that's coming out of Dakota County. Okay. Relationship to your new practices. Representative Edelson, we do have someone from the general public that wishes to offer some quick testimony, so I want to bring him up.
Oh, stay here.
And please stay nearby in case there's some questions. Welcome to the committee, sir. Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you. My name is Brian Fullman. I am an organizer with Isaiah. I am lead organizer with Barbershops Creating Change in the Black Congregation Collective. We just did a rally here. We did a rally in the lobby day here, but when I heard this hearing was going on, I had to come over here. The reason why I got into this work is because of the way my son was treated. My son was truant. He was confused about his identity. He didn't want to accept who he was, and so he started rebelling. And because of that, the police took him, and when he had court, I couldn't believe that he had shackles around his ankles. And when I first seen that, I mean, they didn't put shackles around my ankles, and I'm from the south side of Chicago. And when I was in Cook County, they didn't put shackles around my ankles. I couldn't understand that, and especially considering the distance in which they transported him. So it made me feel some kind of way. And I'm here to tell you that the psychological damage that did to my son, right now you can't pay me enough money for. Right now I still have to coach my son, he's 22 years old, around who he is and his confidence and his self-esteem. So I don't know quite everything you all are in here talking about, but I'm going to tell you this. The way we invest in our kids have a lot to do with what our future's going to look like when all of us are old. And I'm here to tell you, when you're shackling kids and you don't have alternative programming for them, which way do you actually think they're going to go? What kind of reflection do you think they go see in the mirror if we treat them like animals? So I don't have a lot to say other than that. I want us to understand that and be grounded in the fact that we have to be more compassionate with our kids and not punitive. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. And I think your testimony aligns with what Professor Moriarty was laying out for us in terms of what's happening with the development and what we're learning about the development of young minds. And by the way, brother, I'm a West Side Chicago.
Amen. Man, so.
Very well. We have questions. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing this bill. I think it's really a good bill. I just want to reiterate what one of your testifiers started off with, in that this bill does not prohibit the use of restraints. It just says you have to have a reasonable rationale and some sort of overriding concern for safety before they are used. You don't use them indiscriminately. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Considine. Our lead, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, this is, I'm not sure who would like to take this question, but I know some of the state comments that were said of what's happened in the courtroom bothered me, because I've never seen that happen. I've spent 27 years in law enforcement, many hours in the courtroom as bailiff, working with both juvenile and adult. And as far as I know, I believe there are some rules and procedures that the judges use as far as restraints, and especially with restraints with children. Does anybody know if there's any rules or procedures that the judges use?
And Ms. Davis, it might be for you. I think you had, testified that you had, in fact, had seen or were aware of, but I think we have our county attorneys association in the room that might also be able to help us with that. Ms. Davis, please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'm happy to answer that question, and I know Mr. Small is here, and Judge Small can help answer that as well. So the reality is that it's really justice by geography in Minnesota on this issue. In Hennepin County Juvenile Court, you won't see kids coming into the courtroom in shackles, but in other courtrooms across the state, mostly outstate, you will see that. We've worked really hard with the Sheriff's Association on this bill to narrow in on language that works for the stakeholders around ensuring exactly what the representative said, which is that judges still have the discretion and the authority to do this. There is a rule within the juvenile court rules which talks about the use of restraints, but it's not specific to this degree, and basically that rule is what is allowing this. It has allowed this sort of proliferation of, in some places, kids are coming into court shackled for being in custody for being truant or for low-level misdemeanors, and in other places you're not going to see a child in shackles. Just to speak to the adult issue, there's actually, I believe, a United States Supreme Court case on this. We don't do this to adults in Minnesota. It's not allowed. So this would fix the issue for kids.
Judge Smalls, I saw you nodding in agreement in terms of the rules that exist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I think the answer was very well done here. And yes, there is a juvenile rule. There's a specific juvenile rule. So it's covered by the juvenile rules, and there's probably a difference of opinion on how that's implemented. My experience in talking with county attorneys is that it is used on transport issues rather than courtroom, but I don't have the same experience as she does.
Very well. Thank you, Judge Small. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, testifiers, I've had to work courtroom security a few times, and we've had some very interesting juveniles in there that were very destructive and very dangerous. And we've had long conversations with the judges, and this has happened in more than one county that I was involved in, deciding whether we can or cannot use shackles or any type of restraint device. In fact, most counties have now gone to what's called a taser belt. It's underneath their clothing. So they're not shackled. They use it both on juvenile and adults. So there is no shackle shown. There is no restraint shown. The only time that I'm aware of anymore in the court system where I live and in the surrounding areas that I've, and with the sheriffs that I've talked to and the law enforcement personnel I've talked to, it's only with real serious issues and safety concerns involving the juvenile and adults that any type of restraints are used.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the question. I just want to start by reiterating again that this legislation has been worked on over several years with the Sheriff's Association, the county attorneys, to address exactly what you're talking about, which is to say it doesn't eliminate the ability to use restraints or shackles on children, but it's when there's an actual flight or safety risk. And I know it's been brought up a couple of times that this might not actually be happening, but in fact it is based on the experience of defense attorneys across the state and what we're hearing, that kids are being indiscriminately shackled, and it varies by which court you're in. So, for example, up in St. Louis County in Duluth, the Duluth Juvenile Court had been indiscriminately shackling children until, I believe, 2017, when by a judicial standing order, they ended that practice of indiscriminate shackling and moved to a system where they could, in fact, have a case-by-case determination, which is all that we're asking for here, and it's, again, by agreement with stakeholders.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, just one more follow-up question. You talked about the stakeholders. You talked about the sheriffs, the county attorneys, the defense attorneys. But you left a very important one out, the judges. They're a different branch of government. This is their courtroom, and I'm not sure how far we have to say what we have control over their courtroom.
Members, it's 2 o'clock. I want to get to Representative Doerr's bill, and then I want to fulfill our promise from last night to get to House File 9. We have about a half hour once we get to that to wrap that up, but I think we can. However, Representative Dean?
Yes. Mr. Chair, and to the point, I know that oftentimes there are things that are covered in testimony that I have not been exposed to, I have not seen happen, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And I just want to remind us that we all have different sets of experiences, work in different settings, and that sometimes what someone is saying is happening, just because we haven't seen it doesn't mean that it's happening.
Representative Ellison, final words, and then we're going to move to
Mr. Chair, for my final words, I'm going to just have my testifier just be able to answer Representative Johnson's question.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. To speak to the question about judges, I did mention, although it was just a brief line in my testimony, that a survey of judges across the state found that 75% of judges across all 10 judicial districts would support the statewide legislation to end the practice of indiscriminate shackling. And in fact, this bill actually puts the authority with judges. I mean, that's exactly what this does. It says the judge's courtroom, the judge is the one to make the decision. So thank you for the question and thank you for your time.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Davis, for your testimony and for your fine work with the Legal Rights Center. You and I have had an opportunity to do some work together over the years in other areas as well. So thank you for that. With that, the chair lays over House File 1678 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And at this point, I want to call Representative Noor to come forward with House File 1679. I'm wondering, Representative Howard, if you would be so kind as to move House File 1679. The motion would be to pass House File 1679 to the Judiciary Committee. I'm going to check that. We'll work off of that for now because we've been having this issue about where it's moving. But if you would move that, that'll get the bill before us.
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion.
Very well. And are we doing the A1? All right, very well.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair, before you start.
Representative Knorr, your bill is before us. I'll get to you in a second. I just want to get this procedural work done right away. So your bill is before us, is moved by Representative Howard. There is an A1 amendment. Do you wish to have that moved as well?
Mr. Chair, I'll work with all the stakeholders and have another amendment later on, but I'm not going to move the amendment.
That Very well, thank right. you. And Representative O'Neill, I think you had a question?
Yeah, all the other bills had the Minnesota House Research Summary, and this one is coming around. Yeah. That's all I was wondering. Thank you. Hadn't gotten it yet.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1679 is addressing juvenile issues as well. This bill addresses three issues. Number one is the disqualification from the Human Services Program. And that means that if someone has committed an offense in a minor age, we want to make sure that we protect those young kids. We want to make sure that they can come back into the society and become productive members, and not putting a burden on them that they cannot get a job in the health industry or direct care services if it's not a major offense. So this bill addresses that issue, number one. The second part, it raises the court delinquency jurisdiction to age 13. And finally, it prohibits certain juvenile hearing records from the public. Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers who will dive into the deep of this bill. So if you let me, I want to welcome so they can present.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please give us your name and your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Joshua Esme. I am an attorney at the Legal Rights Center, along with my colleague, Sarah Davis. At the Legal Rights Center, actually spend a little more time working with adults in adult court, but kind of my sort of niche area of practice there is dealing with the collateral consequences of records. And in that capacity, I've been collaborating with folks at the Volunteer Lawyers Network and others to put on free legal clinics twice a month, every month, going back to 2012, where people can come in and ask questions about applying for work, applying for housing, trying to move forward in their life, and get advice on, you know, what happens when I do a background check and this record from years ago comes up and, you know, disqualifies me from employment. Both the public hearings aspect and the DHS records aspect go directly to that issue. I'm going to start with the DHS background study sort of part of it. Department of Human Services is required. It's Chapter 245C. They're required to do background studies on everybody who applies for work in a position that puts them in direct contact with vulnerable people or in a facility that provides services for vulnerable people. And it turns out that's a huge swath of our workforce. It is basically everything in healthcare, is basically everything in childcare. It also comes up if someone wants to adopt. It comes up if someone wants to be a foster parent. In years past, DHS has told us that they do between 3 and 500,000 background studies every year, just looking at these issues. And for a lot of the folks that come to my clinics, who tend to be people who can't, you know, who came through the public defender system or the Legal Rights Center itself, don't necessarily have the wherewithal to hire a private attorney to answer questions about their criminal or juvenile record. I can tell you that some of these jobs, the PCAs, the certified nursing assistants, but it's also maintenance staff, it's food preparation staff at group homes. I've had clients who wanted to work as a taxi driver and do medical fares, and a lot of these jobs are, at the same time, they're good jobs, they're jobs with dignity that people take pride in, that, you know, can provide for their family, but are also accessible with a lot of, you know, access to higher education. So I just anecdotally coming through my clinic, I'd say maybe 25-30% of folks who come through have had a DHS disqualification on their background. DHS has statutory access to all juvenile records, public and private juvenile records. So basically every juvenile case can come up on a DHS background study. People get disqualified for various lengths based on the level of the offense, but the lowest disqualification period is 7 years, and that 7 years would start from the end of your probation period if you had one. And then it goes, that, and that's for misdemeanors, so that's things like misdemeanor theft. It can be, you know, low-level assault, fifth-degree assault, low-level fights, that type of thing. And then it goes on up from there, 10 years for gross misdemeanor offenses, 15 years for felonies, and then even permanent disqualifications for a whole host of offenses. The disqualifications can happen for a juvenile if there's an adjudication. Can also happen if there's not an adjudication. If there's a stay of adjudication, that by itself will trigger the disqualification. But even absent all of that, just the arrest and the corresponding record at the BCA and police department record is enough for DHS to issue the disqualification. In fact, they have to. They're required by statute to review that information and determine if there's just a preponderance of evidence, so, you know, 51% sure that behavioral incident that meets the statutory definition of the offense happened. And if it does, DHS is required to issue the disqualification. A client sort of anecdote along that lines, just from, you know, a few months ago at the clinic, we had someone come in who had gotten, you know, a record that resulted from, you know, basically an altercation in school one day. The kids were rowdy and out of line and kind of got into it with one another, and he ended up getting charged with a somewhat serious offense, but went to juvenile court and resolved it just with a disorderly conduct. That was the only thing he was adjudicated delinquent for, and had no idea that it was going to be a problem going forward until he got a job years later working in a group home where both his mother and his sister had worked for years, and found out that because that incident had been, you know, initially went into the police record, the arrest record, as a higher offense, it was still triggering a disqualification. An added complication that came with it is that this wasn't the first time he had applied for one of these jobs, and the last time he simply hadn't followed through on the paperwork, and DHS had made this preponderance of the evidence determination that he had committed this more serious offense, and by not responding the first time when he applied as, you know, probably a 19-year-old, just trying to get a job anywhere, he's forever waived his ability to even sort of challenge that part of it. Really, with the DHS background study here, especially when we're talking about kids, we're recognizing the science on brain development, and really recognizing that juveniles are more easily rehabilitated than adults are. It really makes sense to not be foreclosing future employment for kids based on mistakes they make when they are kids. And really, that's the theme that goes to the public hearings aspect of it, too. So the law there, that goes back to really the mid-80s and kind of the height of concern around the juvenile super predator. One of the reforms that came around at that time was to open up these hearings for 16 and 17-year-olds. I'll say for the entire history of the juvenile system up until that point, all of these hearings had been private. And so the law as it stands now is that if a youth is charged with an offense that would be a felony if an adult committed it, they have a public court hearing that results in a publicly accessible court record. That's the case regardless of the outcome of the case. So even if they're not adjudicated delinquent, or if they are only adjudicated delinquent of a less serious offense, they still have this publicly accessible record. I'd note that there is a pretty big distinction between how the BCA handles these types of records and how the court handles those records, which is that the BCA actually has sort of legislatively set retention periods for these records. And as long as the youth doesn't commit another offense as an adult, the BCA will actually get rid of the records by the time the youth is 28. But the court doesn't have any similar restriction, and the MNSIS records, the electronic records that the court keeps of these cases, are going to be out there indefinitely, and they cause big problems. Employment school, 70% of colleges ask for background checks. And again, we just need to be protecting youth's future.
Very well. Representative Noor.
Mr. Chair, I think everyone has received the House research information. I just wanted to offer the amendment that I withdrew earlier on. That everybody's been briefed.
Very well. Representative Mulder.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Mulder moves the A1 amendment. And Representative Noor, would you care to speak to it, please?
Mr. Chair, this addresses when somebody is, will be a felon if they committed an adult before becoming a 10-year-old or any other. So you go ahead. If the testifier will speak to the details of the offense.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I won't introduce myself again. Thank you for having me here. So I can just speak. I'll speak briefly to the raise the lower age provision, and then briefly to the amendment. Essentially, the provision that is in the legislation recognizes the fact that children ages 10 to 12 don't belong in court. Just pause for a minute and think about a 10, 11, 12-year-old in your life, whether it's a child or a niece or a nephew or a friend's kid. We're talking about a kid who could be in elementary school. The reading level, expected reading level, like Diary of a Wimpy Kid, if you're familiar with that. And we're talking about bringing those kids into court, and this happens in Minnesota. Children of that age don't have the capacity to understand the court process, which impacts their constitutional rights, leaves them not competent to stand trial, which leads to a standstill. The case can't proceed until they're old enough to understand. And this flies in complete opposition to what we know works to change behavior. Community-based services are more effective, more appropriate, and less expensive. And also what we know is that when we subject kids 10 to 12 to jurisdiction of the court, they end up in lockup, and we've heard about that before. Locking up young children is deeply harmful and deeply traumatic. I have to say that the amendment, I understand the idea behind the amendment, but we would welcome the opportunity to work with representatives and stakeholders because it's problematic in how it would impact the ability of advocates to be able to bargain. For example, it would say that if you were 10 to 12, you could be charged with a felony, but the court wouldn't have jurisdiction over lower level offenses. So it would mean that a prosecutor couldn't say, well, then let's amend that down to a misdemeanor or a gross because the court doesn't have jurisdiction over that. So I know we're short on time. I'm going to keep it pretty quick, but that's the general overview of that provision.
Very well. Any questions? If not, then all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Noor, we need to wrap up your bill because we want to fulfill our promise last night to get to House File 9. Let me first ask if there are any questions of the members. If not, Representative Noor, if you can take us out, and then we'll renew the Howard motion to have House File 1679 move to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think that will conclude.
I believe Judge Small, please come forward, sir.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I thought I had signed up to testify. So in any event, my name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And Representative Noor, we agree with Representative Noor with respect to the hearing issues on minor offenses being closed. The opening of the hearing for 16 and 17-year-olds charged with serious felonies, and that means a serious felony if a person is 16 or 17 and commits an offense that would be a felony if committed by an adult. Those proceedings are open to the public. The legislature did that years ago to allow the public to observe and know what the juvenile court does. The reason to have these proceedings open to the public is, of course, not to punish the alleged offender, but to ensure that the public knows what's happening in the courtroom. Openness also helps ensure that all are treated fairly and equally without regard to any economic or racial status. Without public scrutiny, no one knows what's happening, and secrecy breeds lack of accountability and lack of trust. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association does not want the system to be able to do whatever it wants behind closed doors without knowledge of the community. The Minnesota Newspaper Association has expressed these similar concerns in a letter that I believe has been distributed to all the members. And for these reasons, we oppose this portion of the bill.
Very well. Any questions for Judge Small? Representative Noor, Mr. Esme?
Representative Noor, we have a response to that, but I guess I'm being told that for the sake of time, maybe we should just raise that at the Judiciary Committee.
Why don't you give us a three-sentence response?
Sure. So there are other accountability mechanisms built in here. We have an adversarial system for a reason there. And, you know, the idea that it's the serious felonies that we're talking about here just isn't really the case. We have EJJ cases and adult certification cases. Those are the ones that there's going to be the most public interest in. Those are our serious violent felonies. Those can still be open. We're talking about all felonies here. So we're talking about fifth-degree drugs cases. We're talking about criminal damage to property where someone threw an egg at a car. Those are the types of cases that are open under the current system that are causing lifelong consequences for the youth that made those mistakes.
So, sir, what I'm hearing in terms of if this bill moves over to Judiciary, that the framework of narrowing this down would be the subject of that ongoing conversation for Judiciary then, potentially to act on. Is that
it
correct?
And we'll continue to have those conversations, yes.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Noor, final comments?
Thank you so much. I look forward to getting a vote to go to the Judiciary. So this is about our kids, and I want to make sure that we protect our kids. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And so with that, Representative Johnson.
Because of some issues with this bill, I'm requesting a roll call.
The roll call has been requested. Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 1679, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Considine?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Grasso?
Oh.
Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Lesh?
Aye.
Long?
Yes.
Lucero?
No.
Miller?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Nash?
No.
O'Neill? No. Pinto? Pinto? Holston?
No.
On a vote of 9 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Noor. Thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you.
With that, members, and I'm going to ask counsel to help me with this because last night, so what we want to do is move the House File 9. And so last night, it was midnight, so I'm a little hazy, but I think our, and please come forward, Representative Richardson. Yeah, what is the procedural? So then the chair will move. The chair will move to bring House File 9 off the table. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 9 is now before us. So members, we were at the stage of amendments. We had completed the public testimony. We had questions. And what's left for us to do then is to consider the amendments before us. debate those and then move toward this committee's final action relative to House File 9. So let's begin with, in order, Amendment A2. Is there someone offering the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair? So moved.
Representative Lucero moves the A2 amendment. Representative Lucero.
The members and Mr. Chair and members, the A2 amendment seeks to recognize that when a person might be suffering depression, as one example, or whatever other reason a confiscation order might be issued, that as we heard in testimony last night, the most effective way to keep that person or others safe is to remove the person from committing danger rather than attempt to remove dangerous or the firearm from the person. But nevertheless, since that's the way that this bill is written, firearms are not the only thing that can create harm to oneself or another. So this seeks to add to that list motor vehicles, knives, axes, ropes, baseball bats, golf clubs, other sporting equipment, tools, household chemicals, antifreeze, or any other item that might be used as a weapon to create or pose a danger to oneself or another. So, members, I look forward to your support.
You're welcome. Are there any questions? Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at this amendment through the lens of suicide prevention, as you had just mentioned, we know that guns are the most deadly choice in suicide attempts, and other methods of suicide are not as lethal. If you're thinking about guns in particular, firearms are going to be fatal 85% of the time. And we also know that individuals who survive a suicide attempt, 90% of them don't go on to die by suicide. And so really understanding here that guns are going to definitely be the most fatal form, and we know that from a public health perspective. The other piece that I would add as well related to the 72-hour hold piece is we are currently in a real crisis situation with our mental health services, and there are no beds available. So individuals, even if they meet those needs, may not be able to get access to a bed in a timely manner. If you're thinking about it through the lens of a household member who may be in fear of their safety because of domestic assault, we know when we're thinking about intimate partner violence, especially against women, over 55% of the deaths of women are killed as part of intimate partner violence are killed with firearms. So again, that's the most lethal method. So based upon that, I would recommend no on the amendment.
Mr. Chair,
I'd like to request a roll call.
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair.
I'd like to request a roll call.
Very well. Roll call has been called. I do have Representative Johnson next. It's your amendment. Are you responding to this?
I am.
Why don't I give you a time to do that, but I'll just take this in order. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to speak in support of this amendment. I have unfortunately had the displeasure of going to many suicides. The vast majority of the suicides I've been to have not been with firearms. They've been with the chemicals. They've been with antifreeze. They've been with knives, ropes, plastic bags. And one that struck me the worst and the most shocking one I ever went to was a suicide involving a motor vehicle. The person, we ended up finding the note in the car, literally drove down the road till he saw a semi coming and veered directly in front of that semi, severely injuring the semi driver as well. And I believe we should do everything we can to remove the ability to a person commit suicide. So I speak in favor of this bill.
Thank
amendment, I should say.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a point that I also want to bring up is there's a news article from BBC from November 5th of 2018, so not too far back, that crimes involving blades, knives, and sharp objects are on the rise. In fact, there's been a 16% increase in Britain in the previous year of these objects and the harm that they're creating to others, crimes involving these. And so I think if the bill author is serious about wanting to prevent the risk and reduce the risk, this is a very serious amendment. And I would also then just draw members' attention's recollection back to what County Attorney Freeman's testimony was yesterday, that if it can do any improvement, if the bill referring to HF 8 and 9 can make any improvement, that in and of itself is a justifiable reason. So the bill author's comments here that firearms, suicide by firearm, being the largest, which I think is in dispute, being the largest, and therefore we should discount other methods, that's not a good rationale. So to be in accordance with, I think, the intent of the bill author, we should adopt this amendment.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just note that the leading cause of suicide is, in fact, firearms by any information that I'm aware of, and we can certainly debate that if we'd like another time, Representative Lucero. I'll just point out that we do not have an epidemic compared to the rest of the world in these other areas. It is true that motor vehicles, we had a staggeringly high rate, and through a lot of public health efforts over decades, that rate was brought down. This is part of making that same effort when it comes to firearms, or the same approach, same mentality. We don't have that with these other things that are listed. You've referenced what's happening in Britain. That's really good. We're looking to other countries as well, realizing they have a far lower rate. I think this is an important step to take on the bill, and we don't have this in these other areas, and so I don't see that there'd be the need for it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Considine?
No.
Dean?
No.
Edelson?
No.
Croswell?
Yes.
Howard?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Lesh? Lesh? Long?
No.
Lucero?
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Moeller?
No.
Nash?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Pinto?
No.
Poston?
Yes.
Going back to the roll call. Lesh? Lesh. Okay.
Six, ten, seven. Very well. On a vote of seven ayes and nine nays, the motion does not prevail. We have House File A3. Is anyone offering House File A3?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero moves House File, it's not House File. Is anyone moving the A3 amendment? Maybe we should look up House File 3 to see what that is. Representative Lucero moves the Amendment A3. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would draw members' attention to the bill as amended, lines 13.8 through Section 9, Subdivision 2. In this section, a law enforcement agency shall be immune from civil or criminal liability for any damage or deterioration of firearms, ammunition, or weapons stored or transported pursuant to 624.7165. And to me, that is shocking that we would deprive somebody of their constitutional rights. And according to other lines, the minimum, if an order is granted, is it's on line 8.29, not less than 6 months, up to 2 years, unless there's an extension granted. That if something happens, government, it is the responsibility of government. Somebody has been forcefully denied their constitutional rights. to have firearms stored involuntarily, and if damage of any kind occurs, government absolutely is responsible. They should not be held immune from liability due to damage. So, members, I would encourage support for the A3 amendment.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, looking at the liability provision of the statute, it currently provides that if there's recklessness or gross negligence or intentional misconduct, that would not be covered. So the statute would require that law enforcement is not acting in a reckless way. So I would recommend no.
Very well. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
I would ask for a roll call, and then I do have a question for the bill author.
Roll call has been asked for. Representative Lucero.
For the bill author, then, can you define recklessness, gross negligence, and intentional misconduct?
I would ask...
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I would ask Representative Pinto if...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to do a handoff. I'm looking over Mr. Diebel, who may be a better source. I will simply note, members, we talked about negligence versus gross negligence at another hearing, and simply note that there's this. It seems to me, members and Representative Richardson, that what this is setting up is that, and what both folks would imagine, is that we would want to hold law enforcement agency liable if it acts in a reckless way, in a grossly negligent way, certainly is acting in an intentional way. Beyond that, we want to make sure, as we do in other conduct of agencies, that without that kind of behavior that we would have, that there would not be, to not have liability in that case. But there may be more of a definition to provide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, well, that was not a satisfactory answer whatsoever by the bill author or Representative Pinto. So I would ask for a clear definition of recklessness, gross negligence, and intentional misconduct. And if I heard Representative Pinto correctly, it sounds like there's at least a definition for negligence and gross negligence. And I would want to know what those definitions are, but then the other two as well.
Is that a question for our legal counsel then, perhaps?
Whoever can answer, counsel, yes.
Very well. Mr. Deep.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, members, I would have to prepare a memo with that information to provide an accurate answer. It's in case law as well as application. So I think in this case it would require litigation to determine whether they didn't meet the standard that's imposed or proposed to be established for the care and maintenance of the weapons.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, it would seem to me that at a minimum the bill author should be prepared to be able to answer this. This is the language in the bill. And so, again, that's very frustrating that the bill author cannot answer how she has put language in here, the definitions. So maybe for Representative Pinto, if he's willing to yield, could you at least define for us, based on your experience, the difference between negligence and gross negligence?
Representative Pinto, and then members will use a roll call on this, and we'll take a vote on the
amendment. Mr. Chair, if I could jump in here.
Representative Dean.
I've been in committee meetings for the past 7 years, and I've never heard a committee member ask another committee member to yield to answer to a question. This seems very beyond the scope of what we do in committee hearings, and I would just ask the chair to consider that.
Chair Dean, thank you. We did have Representative Richardson call on Representative Pinnell for advice, so I'm just trying to stay in an equal footing, and then perhaps I should not have allowed that at that point. But let's have Representative Pinto's thoughts on this. And then, members, I want to move to a vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, my understanding in looking at this is we're talking about a significant failure to exercise due care. And it seems to me that Minnesotans would agree. I'm looking at Representative Lesch to some sense of that. I guess what I'd note is that I think for Minnesotans, the thought would be that that we certainly would want to have, if there is some recklessness, some way in which there's this significant failure, that there be liability. And then beyond that, to recognize that, as is true in other actions of law enforcement, that we're going to hold law enforcement to that standard, that that if they're going to be acting in a way that is fails to comply and has that significant failure, that this would kick in at that point. I, as you know, Mr. Diebel didn't have that language at hand. I don't myself, but certainly have that sense and would offer that to you.
And I'll wrap it up, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Representative Pinto. I didn't mean to call on you unexpectedly, but it was only because of that, of Representative Richardson having done so. So then, essentially, members, what we're hearing then is that we are going to permit, under the current language, government to act with negligence. That would be permissible, and then the person would have no ability to recourse. If government acted negligently with their private property, it is only until at least gross negligence was reached. And so that, to me, members, that should be very shocking, and I would hope that members would vote in support of the A3 amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I've served a lot of domestic abuse restraining orders, and in those orders, that we've been given orders by the judge to pick up the firearms. This language is not in those orders, in that part of the statute, in your bill with the liability for damage, exemption for liability. If you're going to put that language in a bill like this, do you think it should also be in the statutes to protect the sheriff's office from damaged firearms in the domestic assault case?
Representative Richardson, I'll provide some latitude here. We're wandering off of the bill before us. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, there is another stop for this bill, judiciary, and we anticipate that there are going to be some changes between then and now, and so that would provide an opportunity to look at that further.
Members, if we don't finish this soon, we will be back here later to finish this bill. We had a pretty good understanding last night. When I was speaking with my colleagues across the aisle, that we would move expeditiously today, and so I'm calling on all of us to honor that agreement that we had among ourselves informally. Chair Lesh, are you not on?
I'm passing, Mr. Chair.
Very well. With that, the roll call being called, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Christensen? Considine?
Nope.
Dean?
No.
Edelson?
No.
Russell?
Yes.
Howard?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Lesh?
No.
Long?
No.
Lucero?
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Moeller?
No.
Nash?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Pinto?
No.
Holston?
Yes.
10-7. Very well. At a vote of 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. We have the A4 amendment. Representative Lucero, are you moving that as well?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A4.
Oh, you guys switched up. I mean, Representative Nash moves the A4.
Always a hanging curve, Mr. Chair, and I would request a roll call on this amendment.
And a roll call has been requested.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we've had a conversation around the action of law enforcement agents in this particular confiscation or storage of the firearms, and this amendment seeks to provide some assurance to the gun owner who may have their property inventoried and stored. And I'm going to use myself as an example. I have a number of firearms that are of quite high value. If a firearm comes back damaged, the value is decimated. And I think that law enforcement agencies, particularly sheriffs, they are very close to people. They don't want to be seen as an agent of damage to these guns because some of them, as one of the testifiers mentioned last night, they're being passed down through family, as was the gun I mentioned of mine. So I think in order to do that, you know, there should be an addition in here of some things. Inventory of the confiscated item, a photograph of each firearm with a high-resolution imaging equipment, a receipt to the respondent, and that these items be stored separated by owner in a secure, climate-controlled room. I think that anybody who understands the impact of dampness or weather on a firearm, it's profound. Rust can happen if it's not stored carefully and properly. And I think that what should happen if this bill were to become law, and again, I hope it doesn't, but if this were to happen, that we should take those owners' valuable property into consideration. And Mr. Chair, again, I renew my motion and ask for the roll call.
Very well. There is an amendment to the amendment. Representative Mulder, I believe you're going to offer the A11 amendment?
That's correct. So moved.
Very well. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay. So this amendment would basically mean that a law enforcement agency that receives a firearm would be required to take reasonable steps to avoid damage to the firearm during storage. Law enforcement is very used to handling evidence, and I think it's fine to just say take reasonable steps, and they're not going to be just throwing these guns in some sort of bucket or not taking care of them. I don't think we need to outline specifically what it is they have to do. I think reasonable steps takes care of those concerns.
Very well.
Mr. Chair, to the amendment, Mr. Chair, I have been, I've toured some of our law enforcement as a friendly tour, and Representative Johnson and I talked about this some, and I've talked about it with several sheriffs. Some evidence lockers in various places around the state are quite small. They are not going to be able to handle a large number of firearms being stored. And, you know, obviously nobody's going to put a gun in a bucket, but they could put it in an old locker that is going to scratch the finish on a gun. That, I believe, is not something that we want to force on our sheriffs. And as a result, I would urge a no vote on your amendment, because you're now saying that you're going to release anybody from responsibility, and you're saying, oh, well, it's okay, we'll just put it in a bucket, or it's going to be okay. That's not okay. They need to take proper care, and to do that, they need to hand back to the gun owner the same number of guns that they got in the same condition that they went in, and I would urge a no vote on this amendment to the amendment.
Very well. Members, are we ready for vote?
I would call, Mr. Chair, I would move for a roll call on my amendment to the amendment, please.
Roll call has been asked for. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
I'm sorry, Representative Lucero, I wasn't looking up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make it quick. I was just going to speak against the amendment to the amendment, A11, because as we saw in the previous vote, that reasonable steps could be taken, but as long as they didn't reach the threshold of gross negligence, then it would be permissible. But as long as they stayed at the level of negligence, they still wouldn't be held liable. So I would speak against the amendment to the amendment.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Stein?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Grosso?
No.
Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Lesh?
Aye.
Long?
Yes.
Lucero?
No.
Miller?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Nash?
Nope.
O'Neill?
No.
Pinto?
Yes.
Colston?
No.
Very well. On a vote of 10 ayes and 7 nays, the amendment to the amendment does prevail. We now have the amendment before us. The roll call has been
Mr.
asked.
Mr. Chair. Well, so you've amended the amendment to make it toothless, and you're going to put sheriffs and law enforcement agents in a tough spot, and you're going to put another elected official in a tough spot in the sheriffs in our 87 counties. So I hope you're pleased with that, and I'm now going to withdraw my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash withdraws the A4 amendment as amended. We have the A6 amendment. Is someone offering the A6 amendment? Representative Grassl?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grassl offers the A6th Amendment. Representative Grassl.
A6.
Representative Grassl.
Are we all on the same sheet of music now? Okay. Representative Pistol. To the A6 Amendment, Mr. Chair. Some of the discussion last night was around 72-hour holds and such, and I was a little bit taken back when our county attorney that was testifying and our chief that was testifying were starting to pull away from using the 72-hour hold, rather using this using the method that's involved in this bill, where they would have the slip from the courts to the petition from the courts to go and seize the weaponry, but leave the individual behind, the individual in crisis, as it was stated by our author. And it fell on me that I don't like to make a diagnosis or make an evaluation of somebody that I'm not educated. I don't have that type of education. I don't know whether they should be put back out in the public. But as a deputy sheriff, I would bring somebody in crisis to the emergency room and have medical personnel, somebody more qualified than myself, talk to them, see how they're doing, and if they sent them back home, then I figured it was a better assessment than I could ever give them. So with this amendment, Mr. Chair, I'd like to, the Commissioner of Public Safety, Extreme Risk Protection Order Study Report,
Senator Grassl, we're about at the five-minute mark before we got to go. So,
gotta make sure I have the right one here. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's good, but we got to keep moving.
Oh no, I got them mixed up here. I apologize.
I'm as tired as you are.
I'll back up here. That was the A9, and that is my fault, sir.
Representative Grassl, are you still moving the A6 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We could vote. Yeah. All in favor. All right. Why don't we take a vote? We'll keep moving. All in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Members, the last amendment, the A7 amendment, is someone offering the A7 amendment?
That is my amendment.
Very
That's
well.
The one I was
talking about. We already heard an explanation for the vote. Representative Grassl, quickly, please.
If the A7 amendment, if the court issues an emergency extreme protection order, I would ask that the court also order a 72-hour medical evaluation pursuant to 253B and issue an order for law enforcement to detain and transport the respondent to a secure mental health facility immediately.
Very well. Representative Long, I believe you have an amendment to the amendment.
I do. I'd like to move the A10 amendment to the amendment.
Representative Long moves the amendment to the amendment, the A10 amendment. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As County Attorney Freeman testified yesterday, taking away somebody's liberty is a higher bar than extreme risk protection order, and we should use that with great care. I don't believe that this should be triggering action of taking away liberty, and so I would ask that we move my amendment.
Very well. All in favor of the A10 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grossman. The A7 amendment as amended.
Mr. Chair, at this point, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Very well. Representative Grasso withdraws the A7 amendment. Members, we are before the bill. I do want to share that NABI did send us a memo, so please read that in terms of their thoughts on House File 9. And we're going to take a vote on action on House File 9. And Representative Johnson?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, mm-hmm. I have a lot of heartburn with this bill. There's a lot of problems, a lot of lack of due process, so it has a lot of concern. One thing our side of the aisle has brought up some amendments, some of them a little different, like taking away your car and knives and guns, but that was to prove a point. It was to prove a very significant point that this bill does nothing to help the person in crisis. That's what we need to do. We need to help the person in crisis. I've also talked to some friends of mine all across the state in the law enforcement community. They have the same concerns. But they're the ones that are going to have to go in and confront these people in crisis to remove their firearms and their constitutional right. They're concerned about it. I've talked to my sheriffs in my community. They're concerned they do not have any room left in their facilities for firearms. And they don't have climate control rooms to provide the proper storage of these firearms. Most of them there are full. They're stacked up leaning against each other. And they're getting sued daily for damage. Or not daily, but they're regularly getting sued for any damage. I know because my department has been sued more than once for that issue. Yes, there's some liability. But if they rust, that's not covered. They could call that gross negligence. They can get sued. So with that, I'm going to ask everybody not to support this bill because it does not do what it's intended to do. It's hurting people and not helping the people it's designed to help.
Mr. Chair.
I would also like a roll call.
There we go.
Roll call has been asked for and will be taken. Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't say much throughout the hearings or anything, actually, throughout the hearings yesterday and today, but I did want to say that I have been listening intently as well as to the comments that have been made. And it struck me by the comments that were made last night and through email that we got that these bills were a slap in the face to law-abiding gun owners. The argument was made that because criminals don't obey laws, that these bills or these laws wouldn't be worth the paper that they were written on. That's a direct quote. And I just want to point out how dumb of an argument that is. Members, you know, the people of Minnesota are not really dumb. I think they can get laws most of the time. But keep in mind that that's an argument against having any criminal laws whatsoever. Criminals don't obey them. So don't make laws. I mean, seriously? Like, who came up with that? And I'm not accusing the local folks, the good local folks of doing that, because I know that that's, I think, probably carved into marble above the main doors of the NRA somewhere that was paid for by whoever was dumb enough to give them money over the last 20 years. But the fact is,
Mr. Chair,
that you've got,
Mr. Chair,
I'm in the middle of,
Mr. Like, Chair, we're now dealing in personalities, time. So I would urge you to recommend to Representative Lesh that he avoid personalities.
Does the NRA have a personality? I don't know. It's not a person.
Representative organization. Lesh, let's make sure that we keep to the topic before us. Representative Lesh.
Will do. I looked up a few of the people who made these statements about being law-abiding gun owners. And the statement was that these are, you know, criminals are the ones that we should be targeting. And I only looked up a handful of them. And the handful that I did look up had criminal records. So what am I to think of that? What am I to think of people saying, you got to punish the criminals? Don't punish law-abiding gun owners. And I look them up on MnSIS, and they had criminal records. Now, these are not major crimes, okay? These are, you know, criminal traffic crimes, disorderly conducts, whatever, they're not major. But the fact is, when you lump everyone into one group and you say that this is a black and white issue, that this is two-dimensional, you get yourself stuck on that same two-dimensional line. And then this is not to discount the testimony of these citizens. You know, I take their words and I take them seriously, but I say this to highlight the absurdity of the hyperbole to which this entire debate has descended. So despite the hyperventilating that this is a simple black and white issue, that it takes good guys and bad guys, and if we just focus on the bad guys, we'd solve this problem. It's a disservice to us. It's a disservice to the debate among the citizens of Minnesota of what we can do and what we should do. So I would point out, Mr. Chair, that I do legitimately, I have a few reservations about House File 9. And about the due process restrictions on that. I'm not going to lie. But I would note that this shortcutting of due process is already in existing law when police arrive at a domestic assault scene. It's already there. And I didn't see a single person wearing a yellow button saying support due process when we passed that law. Nor did I see a lot of these people who testified here yesterday come around and defend due process when we had plenty of people in this state who were denied due process routinely for the last 50 years. They didn't come around, but they came around when they think we're denying their due process. So I'm just saying, Mr. Chair, that I think that there would be more credibility on that argument if that happened. That's all I had to say. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lesch. We have Chair Considine, then Representative Mueller, and then we'll finish with Representative Richardson, and we'll take the vote.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Separate from the nine is I am really troubled that several of these amendments seem to impugn the integrity and the competence of our law enforcement. I find that real troubling. Thank you.
Representative Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to take us back to why we're doing this again and talk very briefly about the survivors. The very first case I ever worked on, the first trial I worked on, was a murder. And it was a murder of a domestic violence situation in which the defendant told his sister that he planned to kill himself and take someone with him. And he then shot and killed his girlfriend. I've worked on a number of cases involving gun violence, either to commit a sexual assault or murder cases. We've heard from people in our communities. I know Representative Howard heard about 24-year-old Jonathan O'Shaughnessy, who was walking home from a July 4th festival and was gunned down. I've heard about Shelley Joseph Cordell, who is 56 years old, and in the course of her work helping people, encountered a woman who had a history of threatening behavior. And she was very scared. There were threatening letters. Dead cats began showing up. And every time Shelley called the police, they told her there was nothing they could do until this woman actually hurt her. And then that woman went to a gun show, bought a gun for $60 through a private sale with no paperwork or background check, lured Shelley and her attorney to the Hennepin County Government Center, where I work now, and then shot them both and killed Shelley. So I just want to bring this back to the survivors and why I feel like this bill is important and why I'll be voting yes today.
Thank you, Representative Mulder. Representative Richardson.
I think that says it all. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Representative Mueller.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
And I'm sorry. Let me make sure I'm procedurally being correct here. Representative Pinto, it's your motion that House File 9, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Very well. So the motion is before us properly. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Yes.
Christensen.
Yes.
Considine.
Yes.
Dean.
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Raffel?
Nope.
Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Lesch?
Aye.
Long?
Yes.
Lucero?
No.
Miller?
No.
Mueller?
Yes.
Nash?
No.
O'Neill?
No.
Pinto?
Yes.
Poston?
No.
Very well, members, on a vote of 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does prevail. The DFLs need to get to caucus immediately. I want to thank every member of this committee for the way that we've conducted ourselves through a very difficult issue. Thank you to our lead, Johnson, for helping to set that tone. Members, this committee, until next week, stands adjourned.